You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Judith Sears Poisson. Coming up, the USS Indianapolis was sunk in 1945 while on a top secret mission in the Pacific, killing almost 900 men. We'll talk to one of the 14 remaining survivors about his experience.
Now, election night 2018 is finally behind us, and with interest high in this year's midterms, predictions about how it would turn out were all over the place.
There was talk of a blue wave among Democrats, a red wall with Republicans, and speculation that this could be the year of the woman.
Amber Wachowski is an associate professor of political science at Marquette University. She's with us now to talk about how the pre-election forecasts panned out this time around. Amber, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Well, first, before we get into yesterday's election, coming out of 2016, there was some skepticism of polls. Polls in some places got things wrong, or things broke in a certain way that went to sort of the outer limits of what the polls predicted. Were you sharing that concern about polls coming into 2018?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, not so much. And I think part of it is the narrative that came out of 2016 with reading those public opinion polls. You know, if you looked at the margin of error, how much uncertainty those polls had, Nate Silver, I think, at 538 has written quite extensively on it, that, you know, the fact that Trump won, even though Clinton was up in many of those polls, in the broad scheme of things, was well within the margin of error. So I think it was it came as a shock to many folks, given that most of those polls consistently put Clinton up. But in general, even 2016, I would argue the polls didn't fail as dramatically as I think as it was discussed in the immediate aftermath of the election. So I didn't have those concerns going into 2018 as much.
Right. And in 2016, I remember looking at the 538 outlook, and they said something like Hillary Clinton had a 60-some% chance of winning, which if you translate that into, winning 67% of the vote, that's huge. But no, that's a 2 in 3 chance of winning. You take a die from your Yahtzee set, roll 1 to 4, Clinton wins, 5 or 6, Donald Trump wins. Don't bet the farm on a 2 in 3 chance, right?
You got it, exactly.
So now let's turn to what happened yesterday. And here in Wisconsin, a lot of people have been declaring Charles Franklin of the Marquette Law School poll the big winner. His last poll in the governor's race in particular was a tie, not a statistical, dead heat, a tie. And it was darn close to that yesterday.
Absolutely. Well, I would second that. The polls, and I think the Marquette Law School poll in particular, did remarkably well. And so if you looked at the Wisconsin, the last Marquette Law School poll, you're right. It had Evers and Walker at 47-47, tied. It had Baldwin up over Leah Lukemire, 54-43. It had Call a little bit behind Schimmel, 45-47, but with a healthy share of Wisconsinites saying that they were still undecided about that particular race. That's the attorney general race. And so if you looked at the Wisconsin, at the polling done in Wisconsin, it looked pretty on the mark as the results came in last night.
Talking to Amber Wachowski from Marquette University, political scientist there, looking at polls and elections and how they worked out this time around. Now, Amber, it's one thing, and I'm not going to say it's an easy thing, but it's one thing to try to see who's going to win in a, largely two-candidate race, candidate X against candidate Y. Also, pollsters were trying to look at the House as a whole, which means you're looking at every country or every state in the country, and what happened in the Senate as well. Talk about how complicated that is and how that came out.
Oh, absolutely. Well, the challenge in the House, just for polling, is that you don't have as many polls across the country in many of these House races, so you might be relying on one or two polls. But there's some polling and modeling, kind of taking these polling results from House race by House race. So 393 competitive House races. And by some estimates, the polls were capturing calling the right winner in about 95% of those cases. So again, those are pretty good odds. I would say there is one race for me where the polling was a bit off, and that's Gillum's race. This is the Florida governor's race. If you looked at the polls leading up to yesterday, it had Gillum up, not by a lot, but it felt a little like the 2016 polls, actually, with Clinton kind of just up over Trump by a few points. Likewise, in that race as well. And in Florida, the Democratic candidates for both the Senate and the governor's race kind of underperformed those polls. And so the question is, were pollsters not capturing the Florida electorate? In 2016, one of the themes that emerged, or issues that emerged, was that there were particularly white working class voters who weren't being captured in these polls. Perhaps they weren't picking up the phones, they weren't participating in the polls. They seemed to be missing from some of these public opinion polls. It's possible that that's what happened in Florida. The other possibility is what we think of as the Bradley effect. And this is where you've got, it's named after a L.A. mayor, Tom Bradley, who ran for governor in California in 1982, was up in the polls and lost. And the question was whether or not people taking and responding to those public opinion polls were overstating their support for the black candidate, telling the pollsters that either they were supporting or not supporting the non-white candidate, or saying that they were undecided in the race, perhaps out of some maybe social desirability. Now, whether or not we see that in the Florida polls, it's possible, but I'm not sure, because we've also got Georgia, and those polls that were done with Kemp and Abrams, as of, you know, we're talking right now, that race is still unfolding. Those polls tended to have Abrams behind just a little bit and seemed to kind of be well within the results that came in. So if there was one maybe outlier, I would say it would be Florida. Florida seems to be more Republican than appears in some of these public opinion polls.
Now, we sometimes hear candidates say the only poll that matters is the one on election day. I hear that from pollsters sometimes, too. Is there a value for the public to have these polls in hand, for the media to talk about them as we do?
Oh, that's a great, somewhat contentious issue. You know, the media sometimes gets criticized for the way in which they cover elections, that they're focusing too much on the horse race, too much on who's up, who's down, kind of the dynamics of polling. There's been a drop in public opinion polling kind of done. It's not as frequent. And some have argued that maybe that's a good thing, where journalists are now kind of going more in depth into what's going on, the dynamics of the races, what are the issues that the candidates are bringing up on the campaign trails, and placing less of an emphasis. It's also perhaps this year where a little bit more cautious, given how much emphasis was placed on the polls in 2016, that maybe there's some sense that the media kind of held back a little bit some of that coverage and focused less on the horse race as they've done in previous elections. And in my sense of that, I think that's a good thing. I think we want media kind of covering these races. Public opinion polling is a good bit of data input that's coming in, but it's also helpful to put these races into broader context.
Well, the people who are going to study these elections the longest are people like you, Amber, political scientists. Is there value in the polls we've had all along, in the exit polls, as we try to understand and make sense of what just happened?
Oh, absolutely. So a couple things. A turnout. This week, we've been talking about public opinion polling, kind of calling the races for particular candidates. But pollsters were, folks were also trying to estimate what the turnout was going to look like. And Michael McDonald, who is a political scientist who has just really studies voter turnout and gives some predictions, was predicting that turnout was going to be up quite a bit in these midterms. In some places, maybe even rivaling presidential election turnout, or maybe falling somewhere between a midterm and a presidential race. And his prediction for Wisconsin was that turnout was going to be quite high. He had it predicted, I think, about 61% for voting age turnout. And we don't have the official numbers in yet, but, Wisconsin's looking at about a 60% turnout in these midterms, about a 5 percentage point increase from the last midterm election in 2014.
And we're going to have to leave it at that point, Amber. Yeah. I'm sorry, we're all out of time. Thanks to Amber Wachowski, Associate Professor of Political Science at Marquette University. She joined us today to talk about how well the pollsters did in this year's midterm predictions. On the whole, in general, most races, pretty well. People in central Wisconsin are going to have a chance to learn more about a dramatic moment in World War II history this week, the sinking of the USS Indianapolis.
After delivering components of the atomic bomb that would be dropped on Hiroshima in 1945, the USS Indianapolis was sunk, with nearly 900 men losing their lives, many while waiting days for a rescue. It remains the single deadliest loss of life at sea in U.S. naval history.
A historian and a survivor of the tragedy will be giving two talks this week, tonight at 6:30 at Edgar High School and tomorrow at 6:30 on the campus of UW-Stevens Point, both in Marathon County.
Kim Roller is with the USS Indianapolis Association and was named an honorary survivor by the crew. And Dick Thielen is one of 14 remaining survivors of the USS Indianapolis. I talked with them both earlier today when they stopped by our Wausau studio. Kim, can you tell us a bit about the mission that the crew of the USS Indianapolis was on and how it fit into the war in June of 1945?
The reason the Indianapolis was chosen to transport the atomic bomb, which was a very top secret mission, was because they had been kamikaze'd at the end of March, just the day before the invasion of Okinawa. And that kamikaze caused them enough damage to need to go back to California for repairs, which put them in place to then transport the bomb. So they took it over to the island of Tinian, not knowing what they had on board. And after they dropped it off there, they were on their way to the Philippines when their great tragedy happened.
So this was a Japanese submarine that attacked the USS Indianapolis.
Correct.
And what do we know about that vessel and their crew?
It was being led by Commander Motsushira Hashimoto, and he had been in the war for the entire 4 years up until that point, but had not had a successful sinking yet. So when he did see Indianapolis through his periscope, he was very, very excited to contribute to the war cause.
And what time of day was this?
What time was it, Dick?
10 after 12 Sunday night.
All right. So Dick, you and your crew had accomplished your mission of delivering those parts of the atomic bomb. You're sailing back. What do you remember about the moment that you were hit?
Well, I was sleeping topside at the time because it was too hot below deck. But when the torpedoes hit, I went in the air. I can't tell you if I went 2 feet or 20 feet. I don't know. All I know, I came down. I was lucky enough I'd be on the ship yet. I banged my leg up a little bit. I had a few operations on that later. Anyhow, me and 8-10 went aft to go to our general quarters, where the whole quarter deck was engulfed with flame. Mm. Then we went forward again, and me, I don't know, a guy had a knife. We cut down 3 or 4 life rafts, but it was anchored to the gun turret, 8-inch gun turret. We threw them off. And then by that time, the ship was really listening to the starboard side quite a bit. And they cut down a big canvas bag of life jackets, and I got one. Mm. By that time, the ship was really listening. Well, I tried to stand on the deck, and I slipped off the deck. Everybody asked me, says, where were you on the ship when you jumped off? I didn't jump off. The ship left me.
Well, and Kim, the ship sank in 12 minutes, leaving
right.
about 900 men in the water, and
right.
help didn't come for 4 days and five right. nights. Kim, as a historian, what have you learned about why there was such a delay?
There was a delay because the SOS wasn't received. The radio rooms were severely damaged. Radio 1 was completely useless. Radio 2 had minimal function. And there was a whole lot of miscommunication as to where the Indianapolis was going to arrive and when it was going to arrive. So nobody had the complete picture, so nobody knew she was overdue, and nobody went searching.
And Dick, I can't even imagine what those 12 minutes were like while the ship was sinking, but then those days in the ocean, you must have been facing exhaustion, dehydration, and even things like sharks. What was that like? What do you remember about clinging for life?
Well, okay, be easier to let yourself go out there. You had to fight to stay alive, more or less. In other words, okay, I see men take their life jackets off, say they're going down below deck, get a cold drink of water. Mm-hmm. You gulp salt water on an empty stomach, your eyeballs pop out, foam comes to your mouth, and you go totally insane within a few minutes. Within the hour or two, you're gone. In other words, you had to resist not drinking, of course. Mm-hmm. But the biggest thing is trying to help each other out there, but there isn't much you can do. I came from, to help each other. But it's more one-on-one. But most of us are in life jackets, some are in rafts. But
wow.
We went 4 days and 5 nights, you probably know that, without food and water. And we lost more men on that ship, which is 880 men, in one sinking in the history of the Navy. Everybody questions the Arizona, where the Arizona was a couple hours before the war.
And did you ever yourself think about giving up? Because after even one day, let alone 4 or 5 days, the hope of rescue must have been pretty slim.
Well, the story is that my father signed me to go in the Navy. And he took me after boot camp, begged me back, and he shook my hand. He's a strong man, real firmly. He said, "Dick, I want you to come home." I said, "Dad, the war was over in Europe." I said, don't worry about it. Every time I was ready to get up, I could see my dad's face there, and I could feel that grip. And I got home, and I told him so. "Dad, you brought me home." Dad, of course, a little rough talk. "Said, how in hell did I do that?" "Well, you did it."
Wow.
that saved me. It sounded a little far-fetched, but it's true, very true.
We're talking with Kim Broler right now. She's a historian with the USS Indianapolis Association, and she was named an honorary survivor by the crew. We're also joined by Dick Thielen. He's one of 14 remaining survivors of the USS Indianapolis. And Kim, I found it very interesting that the information about this tragedy, this situation, wasn't declassified until the 1990s. Why was it classified until that time, and how did it become released?
Well, there were different aspects of it that were released early on. The fact that they had transported the atomic bomb was put out there. The problem was when they were rescued and the Navy realized that they had lost track of the ship and that all those men had died under their watch and they weren't even searching for them, they were going to have to answer some really hard questions to all those families. So they didn't even release the news about the sinking at all to the general public until the day that Japan surrendered, and that was put out in the papers. And then there'd be a little postscript on the, a little article that the Indianapolis had been sunk with 100% casualties and all of these losses. So there was a big need to cover it up by the Navy to save embarrassment and all of that. But then as time went on, Captain McVeigh, who ended up getting court-martialed, eventually ended up committing suicide 23 years later. And the men had been fighting to clear his name ever since the court-martial in 1945. They doubled up their efforts in 1968 after the suicide. And then again in the late 90s, when young Hunter Scott, who was a little kid doing a project about the Indianapolis, was able to get some of that information released, these men joined him and were able to get the exoneration through Congress.
Dick, for a lot of veterans and survivors of these types of tragedies and of war, talking about it and reliving it can be difficult. What makes you want to keep this story alive and be willing to share it with the public?
I've been doing this for a better part of 25, 30 years. A few years ago, it wasn't very frequently. Since the monument, the Indianapolis, the museum, books, find the ship, whole bunch of things. I go out at least four or five times a month to go talk someplace. A lot of people ask me, I go to school kids, a lot of schools, and people ask me, "Well, what do you go to talk to school kids about?" You come over to my house, I got a great big box, probably 500 letters in it. You read those letters and you'll know why. They get a lot out of it, believe me. A lot. So I'm doing, my opinion is keeping the story alive, but I think I'm doing a real good service to the kids.
Well, and I can only imagine that as a survivor and having lost so many of the men that you were serving with on that ship, I'm guessing that a big part of it is also keeping them alive.
Oh, yeah. Okay. In other words, okay, you feel funny. Years ago, we had a reunion, 1960 and on, every 5 years. And back then, I sat there with 190, 200 other survivors. The last reunion, just last July, we had 5 survivors, including me. Mm. It's a weird, funny feeling to sit there and wonder, you know, wish these guys were here. Because some of them guys, I've become real close friends, and they're all gone. Mm.
Well, Kim, as we wrap up, you and Dick are going to be speaking at Edgar High School tonight and also in Wausau tomorrow. What will you be sharing with the people that you're speaking with?
My part in this is I show up dressed in head-to-toe 1945 vintage, and I give an overview of World War II up into the Indianapolis mission. I go day by day with what they experienced in the water and the rescue. I talk about Captain McVeigh's suicide and what that did to these men, and then the exoneration, and then I go forward into the discovery last August 19th, 2017 of the ship and what that was like for these men, and also for the families of the lost at sea. And then we'll also open it up to a question and answer session with the audience.
Dick, thank you so much for joining us today, and thank you so much for sharing your story.
Okay.
And Kim, yeah, thanks so much for joining us, and I'm sure it's going to be a great presentation.
It will be. You never know what you're going to hear from Dick Thelen.
Kim Roller is with the USS Indianapolis Association, and Dick Thelen is one of 14 remaining survivors of the crew. They'll be at Edgar High School at 6:30 tonight and on the campus of UW-Stevens Point tomorrow evening. Both events are free and open to the public.
Right now, Democrats are celebrating victories in statewide races, including governor, likely attorney general, and U.S. Senate.
But it wasn't the blue wave they were hoping for. It looks like Republicans are going to maintain their big edge in the state assembly and actually expand their margin in the state Senate.
We'll get two perspectives now on yesterday's results. Dan Kopanky is a former Republican state senator and owner of the La Crosse Loggers baseball team. Dan, thanks a lot for joining us.
Glad to do it. Thank you.
And Arvina Martin is a Madison Alder and former chair of the State Democratic Party's American Indian Caucus. Arvina, thanks for coming up to the studio.
Thanks for having me.
Arvina, let's start with you and your reaction. What are you thinking coming out of yesterday's elections in Wisconsin?
You know, excuse me. I think that the results that we saw yesterday show people are getting fed up with the antics of the Trump administration, with things that are happening with the GOP across the state and the country. And I think that we saw that because, you know, all the constitutional offices were won by Democrats yesterday.
And Dan, your reactions to yesterday's outcomes?
A little bit different than Arvina's, obviously. Actually, where Trump campaigned, his candidates won in most of the places. And in Wisconsin, we held, again, both houses and improved in the Senate. So I think the big surprise was certainly, and for us, here is the governor's race.
Well, I want to hit you with what some of our callers already have been talking about. I'll ask you each in turn. We've heard from some callers. We've heard this from our Beyond the Ballot series in some cases and elsewhere, that there are a lot of people out there who may lean either way on the political spectrum. They want to see some cooperation, especially when we have a time of divided government like this. Dan, do you see prospects for that here in Wisconsin with a Democratic governor on the way and a Republican legislature?
I do. The leaders in both houses in the state have been there a while. They were there when Governor Doyle was our governor on the other side. So, you know, they have an opportunity again to do that, and Governor-elect Evers also has that opportunity, and they're going to have to do it come next year when we have to put a budget together for the state by June 30th. So I see that happening.
And Arvina, do you have hopes? Do you think there are prospects for Republicans in the legislature, a Democratic governor to work together?
How about we say cautious optimism? I think that Senator Kopanky is right that you know, if there is going to be anything that comes out of the budget, out of any legislation, that there is going to have to be some spirit of working together.
And Dan, you've been in the legislature. Is this potentially just a recipe for not getting anything done, a budget that, you know, sits on the shelf for months and months past the due date?
I don't think either side wants that. That doesn't sit well with the people out here. We send people to Madison and to Washington to get things done. And the number one thing is in Wisconsin, that start off a new, you know, year is the budget every 2 years. So, and that comes up next year. And so I think there's a responsibility, there's an accountability that has to take place, and I believe that both sides would be up for it. I think that would be a great place to show the people in the state that, you know, both sides can work together.
And Arvina, a lot of what Tony Evers promised on the campaign trail, it's going to be hard for him to do with Republicans in control of the legislature. That said, what are you hoping for after Inauguration Day next year?
You know, I really think that our governor-elect is going to be working hard to work with people and cooperate with legislators, but as well making sure that he prioritizes the things that he's been talking about public education, about the condition of our roads, and really making sure that we can work together to make this happen. You know, he's not a bombastic guy who's going to talk a lot of rhetoric about things. He's a get things done kind of guy.
And Dan, I've heard already roads come up a couple times, not just from Arvina. Is this a place where maybe there's conflict elsewhere on taxes and other things? Do you see roads as something where some of the gridlock that's been happening among Republicans for a few years may get resolved?
I do. You know, this issue has been on the forefront for some time. And I know it's an issue that President Trump talked with Speaker Pelosi about. Future Speaker Pelosi about today already. So I think that is an area that both sides, you know, want some kind of resolution. We want to move forward. Again, we want to show the people in this great state of Wisconsin that we can work together. Roads need some attention, and I think they'll get it.
We are talking about the results of yesterday's elections with guests from a couple different perspectives. Dan Kopanky, former Republican state senator, Arvina Martin, Madison Alder, former chair of the state Democratic Party's American Indian Caucus, and if you'd like, with you. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts and reactions and hopes and fears for what's going to happen next in government in Wisconsin. We even touch on the national scene a little bit. Arvina, divided government here in Wisconsin on the way, divided government in the nation's capital too. What are you watching for there?
You know, I think that we've been throwing a lot of curveballs, and we got some more again today with the resignation of Jeff Sessions. And so I think that we're going to see some quite a bit of discussion about a new attorney general. And I think that it's going to be great to finally have a check on the president and a lot of his more out there ideas that he's been putting forth.
And before I throw that to Dan, Arvina, were there races around the country that you, for whatever reason, were keeping a close eye on?
Oh, yes. I was very excited about the elections of Sharice Davids and Deborah Holland, as well as Patty Flanagan. Deb Holland and Sharice Davids are the first women ever to be elected, Native American women ever to be elected to Congress. Patty Flanagan won her race for Minnesota's lieutenant governor, and it was just a historic night for Native women. I'm really proud of them.
And Dan, I know you were probably focused on Wisconsin, but did you have your eye on any particular races going on around the country as well?
I did. I was watching Florida very closely. Texas very closely, Senator down there, Cruz. And obviously some of the races with some of the senators in North Dakota, Missouri, Indiana, that we were able to defeat an incumbent there. I thought that was very, very important and very telling. And again, that's where President Trump spent a lot of time in those states.
And you mentioned infrastructure as one possible issue you're watching for now with national divided government. What are your thoughts? Do we see gridlock is not a foreign thing in Washington, D.C.? Is there not a formal shutdown, but are the gears going to grind to a halt there with divided control of Congress?
It's a possibility always, but I think, again, starting in January with a new Congress, I'm anticipating Speaker Pelosi will be the new speaker. Working with the president, it's an opportunity for the Democrats in Congress to show that they will work with President Trump and the Republicans in the Senate and vice versa. So I think it'll be very interesting. It's not all bad. I think checks, as Arvina said, is good. And it'll be an opportunity again for both sides to show that they were elected to do something and they're actually going to do it.
Let's bring on a caller now. Joan is with us in Eau Claire. Joan, hello.
Good afternoon. With regard to the election, there was a very large turnout, which tends to favor the Democrats. Even so, with all of these voters, that the gerrymandered districts have had such an impact on keeping on keeping Republicans in office. And that's, of course, the reason for the extreme gerrymandering. My hope is that this being obvious to me and others is that we can come to a state where we are a point where this gerrymandering can be ended and just have fair elections in Wisconsin again, which we haven't had a fair election, in my view, since 2010.
Joan, I'll jump in. Dan, let's throw this at you first. First of all, do you agree? Or do you think that the way the district lines are drawn is part of what's helping Republicans hold this majority, even as they lost those statewide elections?
I do not. Again, the gerrymandering, as she suggests, what the districts have been upheld by the courts here in Wisconsin. And again, we have a mixed bag here in Wisconsin. We elect a very conservative U.S. senator. We elect a very liberal U.S. senator. That's the way Wisconsin is. We defeat Tommy Thompson in 2012. We elect Tammy Baldwin. That's what Wisconsin is like. That's the way we've been. I saw something where this is the eighth straight time that we have chosen a candidate for governor that is the party outside of the president. So eighth straight time. So it falls in line with who we are and what we've been doing here in Wisconsin for some time.
Arvina, do you have worries about the way those district lines are drawn?
Oh, definitely. I think that once we start seeing the vote totals and are able to kind of match up how many votes each candidates have gotten, I think that we're going to see that Democrats could probably do better in districts that are not drawn to their disadvantage. And I'm hoping that with a Democratic governor and a Republican legislature, that we'll be able to come up with more fair district lines.
We're talking to Madison Alder Arvina Martin and former Republican State Senator Dan Kopanky, looking at the results of yesterday's midterm elections.
We want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Did you vote a straight ticket? Or did you maybe go Walker Baldwin or maybe Evers Vukmir? Did you vote? Did you try to get others to the polls? What's the number one issue for you as new officials take office? Call us at 800-642-1234, or you can email us at ideas@WPR.org.
More conversation and more of your calls coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Judith Sears Poisson. We're getting reaction from the left and right to yesterday's elections for governor, attorney general, the state legislature, and Congress. Arvina Martin is a Madison Alder and former chair of the State Democratic Party's American Indian Caucus. And Dan Kopanky is a former Republican state senator and owner of the La Crosse Loggers baseball team.
You can weigh in at 800-642-1234. What's your reaction to yesterday's midterms? Is there a question you want to throw at our guests? Call 800-642-1234 or tweet us at Central Time WPR. Back to your calls now. Mark is with us in Bloomer. Mark, hi there.
Hey, so the Democrats took the House. I'm wondering, when can we start the impeachment proceedings against the Trump presidency? Republicans, I got no problem with it. That man, he needs to move on.
Mark, thanks for the call. Arvina, it would be a tall order. The House can start impeachment. The Senate, though, would have to try it under Republican control. But is this something that you think Democrats in the House should consider, impeachment of the president?
I think that we have to work on some of the issues that are facing this country right now besides the impeachment. I don't know that it's the number one priority. I mean, I think that we need to continue these investigations and go where that leads. But at the same time, we still need to be working on things like our country's infrastructure and relations with the rest of the world.
And Dan, impeachment again might not be on the table, but are you now with Democrats in control of things like the House Intelligence Committee, are you thinking we're going to see more oversight, investigations, whatever you want to call it, of the president from the House?
Well, I think Arvina had a really great answer, and I concur with her on that. But I think it would be very, very, very foolish for the Democrats to begin those proceedings. They will go nowhere, and I think it'll only help the Republican Party.
All right. Thanks for the call, Mark. We'll go to Paulina in Madison. Paulina, hi.
Hi. My name is Paulina Eastfield, and I'm just very happy that we have a new governor in the state of Wisconsin, and that, you know, with Congress and everything, all the faces can change, you know, and, you know, it's women and, you know, in office, and, you know, it's just a we can have checks and balances now. So I'm hoping that everybody can work together and that we don't get off on a bad start and let the future, you know, bring joy for everybody.
Paulina, thanks a lot for calling in. A lot there. I want to key in on one point she mentioned, women. I haven't seen the numbers yet on this, but talk about this maybe being the year of women as candidates and as voters. Arvina, what have you seen? What are you looking at?
I mean, it's been absolutely incredible to watch so many women candidates running across the country, across the state. You know, I got to meet and got to know a lot of the candidates who are running here in Wisconsin for legislative races, as well as, you know, other races as well. And, you know, I think that women are standing up and finally being able to say our voices are important. We have things to say. And I believe there's going to be at least 100 women serving in Congress for the first time ever in our nation's history. That's fabulous and not enough.
Dan, your thoughts? Are you seeing a year of the woman as candidate or as voter?
Well, I will say both sides had, I think, some remarkable candidates this year. And so many of them with some military background, which I thought was a special, you know, for them and for this country. And I think it's great. Good candidates. It doesn't matter, male or female, good candidates are good candidates. And there was a lot of them out there this year.
Paulina, thanks for the call. We'll go next to John in Madison. John, hi.
Hi. I was wondering, since healthcare is first and foremost on many people's minds, I was wondering if there's going to be any movement on the Medicaid expansion through Obamacare. It's not too late for the state of Wisconsin to change course and accept that money. I think either Voss or Fitzgerald said it would never happen under their watch. Does Evers need the consent of the legislature in order to go forward with Medicaid expansion, or can he do it on his own? And do your guests think that there will be any kind of movement on this issue since it's so important to Wisconsin voters?
John, top of my head, thanks for calling. I believe that the legislature needs to weigh in. Dan, maybe you could correct me on that. And if so, what do you think should happen with Medicaid expansion?
No, I believe that the legislature has to weigh in. And that, again, that was one of the issues in this campaign. It'll be addressed. Certainly the governor-elect will bring it up, and we'll be talking about it in the media, and we'll see where that goes.
Would you want to see that expansion, that Medicaid expansion under the Affordable Care Act?
Oh, of course. I think that it is foolish not to take that money when people in Wisconsin need the health care and need it to be affordable.
We are talking about yesterday's elections. Arvina Martin is with us, former chair of the State Democratic Party's American Indian Caucus. Dan Kopanky, former Republican state senator, and with you at 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Scott is on the line in Whitewater. Scott, hi.
Hi. I think it was an amazing statewide victory. Democrats were against huge sums of money, and I know Coingo will say, well, they had money too, but not even close the dark money that comes out for Republicans that doesn't get reported. And then you have a huge media blackout, basically, on Democrats and progressives.
You're breaking up for us, Scott, but I think we get the gist there. Dan Kopanky, not Coinga, he renamed you a different Republican lawmaker. But Dan, do you think, as Scott did, you mentioned you didn't think gerrymandering was a big problem. What do you think of the role of money? Scott saying, hey, a lot of outside money, and it hurt the Democrats, but they still came through.
Well, I think Tammy Baldwin had quite a few dollars, and I think Scott Walker had a lot of time to build up a war chest. That's true, but a lot of money came in on the other side as well. And just one quick comment about gerrymandering. Ask Congressman Ron Kind if he doesn't like the district redrawn after the 2010 elections.
And Arvina, your thoughts on money in the race this year?
You know, I like to see that there were so many Democrats going for small donations from regular people that live in their districts, as well as reaching out to people who might have more money as well. I think that the numbers of small number or small amount donations was really impactful.
Back to your calls. Thanks for calling in, Scott. Mike is with us now in Madison. Mike, hello.
Hi. The money spent on this election was ridiculous. We could have fixed all the schools in Wisconsin. But there's an awful lot of pats on the back going on with the Democrats right now, as well as there should be. But they need to remind themselves that the American public hates lying Democrats as much as we hate lying Republicans. And it'd be nice if this new current political parties that are going to be taking office could actually be honest and respectful.
Mike, thanks for the call. Arvina, do you want to make the case that there is a difference, that one party, the Democratic Party, is more truthful?
I mean, yes. I am speechless, actually. I'm sorry.
Oh, that's right. Dan, do you want to jump in? I mean, do you agree with Mike that people are as skeptical of Democrats as they are of Republicans' truthfulness?
Well, here's the deal. If you're a candidate and you're lying to the public out here, let me tell you, you're going to get caught because the public is very smart. And that doesn't matter if you're a Democrat or Republican.
Yeah, people don't like liars, period. And unfortunately, you know, a lot of people who run for office then get this kind of reputation as liars, as politicians. And, you know, it's not necessarily the fairest, and those people get weeded out fairly quickly.
Yeah, let's start with a look at your hopes for public service, for people in politics in the years to come. Dan, leave us with some quick thoughts.
Well, public service is the word. Key word is service. And we politicians are elected to be of service to their constituents. And if they keep that focus, they'll probably be successful.
And Arvina, your thoughts, your hopes for public service in politics?
I, you know, again, got to meet so many candidates this year that have just very heartfelt feelings and about the direction our state is going and our country is going. And those are the best kinds of candidates that really feel something and care a great deal about putting that work forward so that we can make our home a better place to live.
Well, this just flew by and it was fun. Arvina, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And Dan, thanks to you as well. Thanks a lot.
Appreciate it.
We've been talking to Arvina Martin, member of the Madison City Council, former chair of the State Democratic Party's American Indian Caucus, and Dan Kopanky, former Republican State Senator and owner of the La Crosse Loggers baseball team. We talked to them about yesterday's midterm election results. Thanks for your calls. You can keep sharing your thoughts, by the way, over at the Ideas Network Facebook page.
Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, Congress is split, and now Wisconsin has a Democratic governor and a legislature that is even more heavily Republican. Regardless of who you voted for, we'll ask whether you want to see more political conflict or more cooperation.
And hey, there's more in the world than politics. Gretchen Rubin decided to spend a year on what she called the Happiness Project, an effort to increase her happiness a little bit every single day. We'll check in with her a decade later, and we'll ask how you pursue daily happiness in your life.
We'll also look at the role that virtual charter schools play in high rates of student turnover. And if your student has gone to one, you can tell us about the experience over on the Ideas Network Facebook page.
And a look at the future of Foxconn under a new governor of Wisconsin. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.